Okay, hey everybody, how are you doing? Hey, I got a special guest in the studio, a well-renowned atheist, and we're going to be blabbing. And when we get back out of the music here, we'll do some talking. It should be interesting. Stay tuned.
This is Matt Slick Live with your host, Matt Slick.
My hero.
Founder of CARM.org, the Christian Apologetics Research Ministry. Call now with your questions, Bible questions, God questions, hard questions. Toll free across the nation, 877-207-2276.
That's 877-207-2276.
No fluff, straight answers. And now your full contact theologian. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, everybody. How are you doing out there in Radio Land? Hey, it's me, Matt Slick, and it's a nice Friday, Friday the 7th. A few announcements here. I will be teaching the Bible study at the usual location, first and third Fridays at the Pursuit Church. So if you're interested in attending, all you got to do is go to the web. Just go to the internet and type in Matt Slick Bible Study, and it'll come up. I think it's number one, and you can just find out where and when and the whole bit. Now, just letting you know that I plan on having pizza there tonight. So I don't know if, Dan, you might want to forego the event and go get pizza with me. But we're going to have some pizza delivered about 8:15, and then we'll take a break, and then I'll do some blabbing. And I'm supposed to pick up a friend of mine at the airport tonight, but it looks like his flight will be late. So we can do some extra teaching and stuff like that. So if you are interested in, you know, getting a theological brain fry and you want to know about transcendentals and justification, imputation, propitiation, and things like that, if you want to be taught out of Ephesians chapter 3, then tonight would be a good time for you to come and, you know, walk away later going, ouch, that hurt. But if you like that kind of a thing, hey, I'm your man, okay? So, again, if you want to do that tonight, 7 o'clock. And just remember, I'm going to the Philippines on the 20th, so I will not be teaching this Friday. Excuse me, today I will be, but in 2 weeks I will not be teaching, and won't be teaching again until the, I think it's the third Friday of March, so just giving you guys a heads up. All right. And by the way, for the Philippines trip, if anybody wants to help us out and cover the costs for that as we get out there to preach and teach and help in the typhoon-ridden area, ravaged area, I should say, then please go to CARM.org, C-A-R-M.O-R-G, in the right-hand side. You'll see a link. It says Philippines trip, and you can click it and you can donate some money. One of the things we want to do is just take some cash and leave it with the people there. We do not want to be a burden on anybody. We want to buy the food for them. We don't want them to put us up. We want to be good witnesses for them and help them out. So there you go on that. I really can't think of anything else right now. Okay. In the studio right now, across from me about 3 or 4 feet, is Dan Barker. Dan Barker's a kind of a well-known atheist guy, aren't you?
One of them, yeah.
One of them. And Dan and I debated, I don't know, two-ish, three-ish years ago on can you be good without God or something like that, right?
In Oregon, wasn't
it? In Oregon, Portland area.
Right. Corvallis.
Corvallis, that's right. Yeah. And you and I were scheduled to debate tonight. However, there was a slight, let's be polite, just say there was a mix-up on some things, and so they got somebody else. We'll just leave it at that.
Maybe they were afraid you were going to be too good. Maybe that was the...
Maybe.
You know,
or too slick. yeah, actually, it was Jake. They know who he is and everything, I guess. But he wanted me to not say certain things. But I have certain logical arguments I use and things like that. And if I want to go down a certain area, I don't want to be restricted. And it wouldn't have been ad hominem, which he thought it might have been, and some other issues and off-topic stuff. I don't do that kind of a thing. But nevertheless, that's okay. So I asked Dan, we exchanged emails and then phone numbers. Hey, you want to come on in? He said, sure. We got a coffee together too, didn't we?
Yeah, with some idol on the cover, some Starbucks. What is that thing? It's like a, looks like a mermaid, but maybe it's a pagan goddess of caffeine or something.
Caffeina?
We're both worshiping here as we
Well, I don't know. I like this stuff. It's pretty good.
It is mind-altering, you know. It just kind of.
I need it. So, hey, look, folks, we're going to hold off on the calls just for a little bit. And I figured what we could do is Dan and I, we have no script. We haven't discussed what we're going to talk about, except I just want to intro him and have him introduce himself. And we'll just see what happens. So tell us about yourself. You're an ex-Christian, right?
I'm an ex-minister. I preached the gospel for 19 years, starting at the age of 15. I was one of those guys, you know, the guy with the Bible under his arm on campus, going up to people, asking them about their eternal destiny and their relationship with God, and would they be ready if Jesus came again? I was very, you know, I thought it was a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, I probably was like the campus jerk. Who knows? But I thought I was doing this wonderful thing for the world, preaching the gospel. And I was fearless. I would talk to people on trains and in buses and knock on doors and waiting for the second coming.
That's what I do. Yep. Okay.
So
there we go.
What was that sound like? A voice coming?
Yeah. I turned it. We have a chat room, and I turned it on. I forgot to do that. Huh. Take care of that. My bad.
Oh, that's okay. I thought it was the spirit or something.
Yeah. The spirit of atheism. Okay, go ahead.
So, and I loved it, and I believed it. I was a born-again Christian. I had confessed my sins. I had asked Christ to come into my heart. You know, in Revelation, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him. So I was a true believer. And today, a lot of Christians try to accuse me of not having been a believer. They say, if you really believed, Dan, you would never have left it. But if I wasn't a true believer, then if I wasn't a true Christian, nobody is, because I truly lived it and I felt it. And the Bible even says, you shall know them by their fruits, right? It doesn't matter if somebody judges if you're right or wrong, you shall know them by their fruits. And my life exhibited the fruits of the Spirit, and I loved it. I had no bitterness. And I got a degree in religion from Azusa Pacific University.
Really? SoCal.
And, I was an associate pastor in three different churches in California, and I liked that, but my calling, I thought, was evangelism. So the third church I was in, the first one was a Friends church, and then I was in a Pentecostal church for a while, which was weird. It was fun. I was in an Assembly of God as an associate pastor, and you know, those people were really sincere and really sweet, but way too noisy for my taste, if you know what I mean. Just, the speaking in tongues and all the... And I did that stuff, and I felt it, and you know, I still could, actually, as an atheist. I won't do it now, but I could, you know, I could go back into that mode, and it feels pretty good. I mean, when you're having those experiences with talking with Jesus and God, I mean, it really is a powerful thing. And then I was at an independent Christian church out of the Disciples tradition, and then they sent me off on what turned out to be 8 years of cross-country evangelism, preaching the gospel from church to church. I was also doing Christian music, some record production, and a lot in Mexico. I was a missionary to Mexico for 2 years.
You speak Spanish?
I speak Spanish, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was a pretty good interpreter. In fact, last fall I got to go back to Mexico as an atheist for the second time with a Mexican atheist in Mexico City. Some great people down there. And so I wrote some Christian musicals, which are still selling. Mm. I'm actually still getting royalties today. There's a company called Mana Music, and I worked with Word Records, if you know who Word Music is and Word Records. I worked with them for a while, a little bit. But so my ministry kind of evolved into less preaching and hellfire and into the world, into more of a, how do you live this life? You know, more of a, instead of the afterlife, more about living your Christian life. And I was getting invited more to do musical. I play the piano and sing, and I wrote a bunch of songs. And people wanted to hear the conductor and the composer of the music that their church had performed. So through all that process of getting invited to a big cross-section of Christian churches, I learned that there really is no one Christianity. There's a huge continuum of Christian, from fundamentalist over here to more evangelical born again, and even evangelicals have their splits, and then more moderate types, and then more liberal types. And so I was meeting hundreds of pastors from all across the country, all over the continent really, and getting a taste of different varieties of Christianity that were different from mine. And at first it made me very uncomfortable, for example, to be invited to a church that was more liberal than my own theology was, and yet fellowshipping with these Christians in a more liberal, which I thought was, some of their views were kind of heretical. But I learned that there's a broad cross-section of Christian beliefs, and each one of them thinks they have the right one and all the others are wrong. You know, and they can all actually defend themselves to some degree, they say. But what that did was it sort of liberalized my thinking a bit. It made me not so hard-headed fundamentalist. It made me realize that there's beautiful, good, intelligent, kind Christians all across that spectrum. And do we all have to agree on every point, or can we get along? You know, so that started in my mind in a process of thinking and reevaluating. Until then, philosophically, I started thinking about the actual Christian claims themselves. Because if these two Christians disagree on a point that I thought was really important, for example, the historicity of Adam and Eve, I thought Adam and Eve were two people. They had to be two people. The Bible wouldn't lie about that. There wasn't Adam and there wasn't Eve, and there was an animal, whatever that Nahash was called, mm-hmm. a serpent, whatever right. it was, with no legs, legs and then no legs. And then I was fellowshipping with good Christian people, loving, moral, church-going, Bible-believing people who didn't think Adam and Eve were actually literal. They thought the Adam and Eve story was much like the parable, like the prodigal son story, where Jesus told a quote-unquote non-historical story to make a point. And it didn't matter if the prodigal son was really a real person. It didn't matter. It was the moral tale that mattered. And so these Christians thought, well, it doesn't matter if Adam and Eve exist. And from what we now know about evolution, they couldn't have. Even if they did, we know that we came out of Africa, not out of the Middle East. So Adam and Eve must have been a metaphorical, parable type of thing. And that made me really uncomfortable. I thought, how can I fellowship with Christians who think the Bible is telling a lie? So I went through this whole process. Well, how reliable is the Bible? What parts do we take as metaphor? What parts do we take as literal? And I think that's kind of the history of the church. I mean, different denominations draw their line in different places where they think, where they think right. it's actually literally true and then metaphorically true. And so I went through this process in my own mind of moving that line up and up and up until finally it wasn't just the prodigal son, it wasn't just Adam and Eve, but it was also this other character in the Bible named Yahweh was also a figure of speech, a metaphor, a parable that the human race has made in order to teach us an important moral lesson about who we are as people. So I went clear across that continuum and popped out not believing in an actual God anymore. And by definition, that's an atheist.
Hmm. Now, as you know, I've read a lot of your material. I don't have any of it with me. I don't have any quotes ready to trap you with or anything like that. I just wanted a nice conversation with you. So I've read a lot of your material, listened to a lot of your debates and things like that. And you find that these things are just basically not real.
Well, not all of them. Some of them are real. Some of the Bible is true.
Oh,
okay. You know what I mean? But some of it's not.
Yeah. Did you think Jesus lived?
Well, my confidence in the probabilities of the existence of the actual historical Jesus is low. It's not zero. I'm kind of like Bart Ehrman, who puts it maybe more than 0.5, maybe 0.6. He thinks there actually was. I'm skeptical, but with historical claims, you never have zero or 100. You always have a probability.
Right.
So my confidence in the actual historical existence of Jesus is very low. Maybe, I don't know, let's just say 10%, maybe 20. But my confidence in the existence of the New Testament Jesus, which is a different Jesus than the historical Jesus, is pretty much zero. That character was a caricature, a cartoon character, based on a real person. Maybe a useful analogy would be Paul Bunyan. We don't know if Paul Bunyan actually existed,
right.
this Northwoodsman. We can't prove that he didn't. There might have been this big, giant guy who fought with the French against the British, and he might have done some heroic things. And then later, the legend was told, much later, and of course exaggerated. We do know that this Paul Bunyan, who had a big ox, who he dug the Great Lakes as a watering hole for his ox, we do know that that looks kind of mythical.
I like it, all right,
but on the scale of things, it doesn't look like it's as historical as some regular stories. So we would put a different probability on the existence of the historical Paul Bunyan than we would on the legendary Paul Bunyan. In the same way we do that with Jesus. The historical probabilities of the real Jesus aren't zero. He may have existed. In fact, some atheists think he did. And you can't go back and prove either way.
Right.
But there are also reasons to discount that probability for many other reasons, like that debate I did on the pagan parallels that you saw me do in Oregon, and on the evidence of legendary growth as the stories were told through the first centuries, as the earlier ones were simple and the later ones got more and more elaborate until you get to John where you have all these, 60 years later, you see that kind of footprint of legendary growth and embellishment. So I'm pretty confident that that character that appears in the New Testament, that literary character, did not exist. Although that doesn't mean Jesus himself as a self-proclaimed Messiah, because there were a lot of them. There was a Judas the Christ, there was a Theodas the Christ, there was an Egyptian Jew Messiah. There were other self-proclaimed Messiahs and there may have been a Yeshua the Christ. We can't rule that out.
man, there are so many things I could jump in on. Arguing particulars, I find with atheists, doesn't really get anywhere. You know, I have evidences that I'll trust in that I think are reasonable for the historicity of the New Testament. I can read Greek, so I can translate. I've studied the issues. And so I would take, you know, I'd take issues with some of the things you've said. But I remember I was reading recently, when I was prepping for the debate we were going to have, I was going through some of the old notes. And you said in one of your quotes, I forgot where, that you said you, I'm trying to quote you properly, but basically you said there is no God. Now, you believe there is no God, right?
I don't believe that there is a God.
Okay.
That's different.
Okay, so you don't believe there is a God. So this is the issue of lack of belief?
Atheism is an absence of belief.
Okay.
It's a lack of belief. Although there is a subset of atheists who do make positive belief claims. So if you're talking about the Christian God, I do believe that God does not exist.
Okay.
But if you're talking about any generic possible God, then I don't believe that any of those gods do exist. And that's an important philosophical distinction, to claim that you lack a belief in something. For example, you and I don't believe in leprechauns, although we can't prove it. I mean, if you've ever eaten a box of Lucky Charms, I mean, there you go. There's some evidence for Lucky Charms in culture and in stories and in history, but neither of us actually believes in leprechauns. But I don't think either you or I would say, I definitely know they don't exist with 100% certainty, because they might be hiding, they might be, so you can't prove their non-existence with 100%, but we can justify our absence of belief in leprechauns because of the absence of evidence and the evidence of legendary making and all the reasons that you might be suspicious about the existence of leprechauns, I am suspicious about the existence of a God.
Okay. I'm trying to be polite here and nice and all that, not ambush you, because I don't want to do that.
Yeah, but you're supposed to be the heavyweight, right? So, slug it, you know?
Yeah, I'm slick. I would say that there's some philosophical problems with some of the things that you're saying. And logistically, everything comes back down to the justification of your presuppositions and the issue of examining evidence. But one of the things I talk about with atheists is that they will say they have a lack of belief or an absence of belief in God. And then I follow up usually with a question similar to this. Well, do you behave based on what you believe or what you don't believe? And I think universally true that we behave in a manner consistent with what we do believe, not with what we don't believe. Our actions are motivated out of our affirmations, not our denials. I don't know of any example that can falsify that. I mean, it seems to be true. So, if you know, if say that your opponent tonight gets sick and they call me in to come debate tonight, which, you know, I would do, you know, just impromptu, give it a shot. Well, you know, we could be talking about various issues. And I just lost my train of thought. Darn it. The issue of evidence and presuppositions.
Some more coffee there.
Yeah, that's right. I could do some more coffee, drink of the pagan. You know, that's really odd. I completely lost my train of thought. I don't do that very often.
Presuppositions.
Yeah, it's about presuppositions, but there was a certain point within that I was going to go into. Oh, yes, absence of belief and behaving based on what you believe, not what you don't believe. So if you were to defend the idea that God does not exist, because if I were to give an argument, which I've got several arguments for God's existence, and then you were to refute them or try to, then you're doing that based on what you believe, not what you have lack of belief in. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, in a very basic sense. I mean, sometimes we do base our actions on something that we don't believe. I don't believe the road out there is made out of tissue paper, so I'm going to drive on it, right?
Right, because you believe it's made out of something else.
Well, whatever, yeah, you know, right. And it might be made out of tissue paper. It's possible. I mean, the possibility is very low. Some of our assumptions are wrong. Some things that we believe or don't believe turn out to be, you know, mistakes, but I would say in my case, and I don't speak for all atheists, some atheists would say it's totally different from me, because atheism is not a creed, atheism is not a religion that we all have to sign and agree to something. Unlike Christianity, where Paul said Christians should all be of one mind, there should be no divisions among them, they should speak, there should be, God's not the author of confusion or disorder. But atheists welcome disagreements, and we do disagree, and we like that, because disagreement is where we learn, right? In fact, our
hopefully.
Well, we do.
Yeah.
I mean, if
yeah.
you're committed to learning, I think what most atheists would say is that we do have a respect for human reason. And I think that's where you're going with presuppositionalism, that we think there are some ways to use your brain in a reasonable way to come to some high justifications for claiming some things are true or not true.
Yeah. I'd call this humanism, where man is a center and the standard of judging what is true and right and thoughtful and everything. That's incidentally creeping into the Christian church. That's something I've been talking about.
Well, that's good for the church then. I hope that happens.
Well, no, because there are certain presuppositions that go along with it that cannot be justified from that perspective. I'm a rational guy. I really believe in using logic a great deal, as people who listen to the radio show know. And I like to argue about transcendentals, about necessary preconditions for intelligibility, about necessary and sufficient conditions for existence and justifications for positions. I think a lot of Christians can't do that. And not knocking them, they're not trained to do that like I am. But when I talk with atheists and I have impromptu debates, one of the things I will do is get into the issues of their presuppositions and what justifies those. Because ultimately, if I can present to you evidence, it's your presuppositions that'll deal with the evidence and how to interpret it. And if I were to deal with the issues of what you assume to be true and is your assumption cogent and internally consistent, well, that's where I find lately, more and more in the past year, I'm finding more and more is a profitable discussion. And I don't believe atheism has the, and I don't mean to be offensive, I'm not trying to call you stupid or anything, I'm not doing that. It's just, I do not believe that atheism is intellectually viable. I don't believe it has any ability to defend itself as a rational position once it's been thoroughly examined. Now, I think there are people who are ignorant about certain things and they can, I don't see enough evidence, and I think they could be atheistic within that limited realm of rationality. But once it's truly examined, I think that atheism can be shown to be just inviolable.
So would you apply that criticism to not just atheism, but to any system of absence?
Absolutely.
Would you say that aleprechaunism is not intellectually viable?
Yes.
That leprechaunism is more intellectually viable than aleprechaunism?
Well, if we were to talk about leprechauns, which we know are supposed to be mythological creatures throughout history, I don't know where they came from, then I would know that those are the intended discussions that they were to be held in that culture.
But how do you know that? Maybe
well,
they really were.
So
right?
Maybe there was something going on.
Yeah, maybe there were leprechauns.
Yeah.
I mean, you're making an assumption right there
that
you know something about how cultures create their myths. And that's fine. I think we do have to have assumptions.
Yeah.
Otherwise, how are we going to proceed? We have to make some assumptions, and we can discard our assumptions. But you got to start somewhere.
We all have to start somewhere. For example, rationality or the laws of logic are necessary. We cannot justify their existence without presupposing their validity, which is begging the question. So everybody has to, and to some degree, just start at some position that you can't prove is true, and basically rationality. I believe that atheists and Christians have at least that in common, in that we can be rational. Now, to what degree we can be rational and agree, in Christian theology, we have what's called the noetic effect of sin, naos, mind, the effect of sin on the mind. Now, I think that atheistic presuppositions are unjustifiable, namely, that there is no God, because functionally, atheism works from the position there is no God, functionally.
But that's not a presupposition of atheism. It is a conclusion of most atheists, but it's not a presupposition.
And how would you conclude that God isn't?
I would be happy to believe that there is a God. I'm not presupposing there's no God.
Okay, so what is it that your presuppositions or your assumptions lead you to believe there is no God?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about tonight in the debate.
Oh, you don't want to give that away right now?
No, let's do it.
I've done this
debate over 100 times.
Okay.
I'm not hiding anything. It's not like there's any secret weapons or
Okay, all right.
But most atheists will say, and I speak for myself, and I think many atheists or most atheists, that there's at least a half dozen absences, and the strongest one, of course, is the absence of evidence for a God, just like we would say there's an absence of evidence for leprechauns or unicorns or whatever. Also, the absence of a coherent definition of a God is another.
Let's talk about that one real fast, and then get to the evidence issue.
Well, there's evidence, and then there's the absence of a definition. Let me go through them real fast, then we'll go back up to one of them. Absence of agreement among God believers. As I quoted Paul from 1 Corinthians saying that there should be no divisions among you, and yet can you find a religion that's more divided than Christianity? Christians can't agree on not only the nature of this God they believe in, but on the moral principles of this God. The absence of a good reply to the problem of evil, and the absence of a need, because hundreds of millions of good people live happy, moral, loving, productive, meaningful, purposeful lives without a belief in God, just as good, if not sometimes better, than those who do believe in God. So when you total up a cumulative case of absence, because atheism is not a thing, it's the absence of a belief in someone else's belief is what it is. Like, just like a leprechaunism is the absence of a belief in whatever the Icelanders believe in. We don't embrace what they are embracing. Cumulatively, it seems more reasonable not to raise the probability for the existence of God very high. It doesn't make it zero. It doesn't prove there's no God. But, you know, snakes don't talk. Food doesn't fall from the sky. Disembodied hands don't float in the air and write on the wall. People don't walk on water unaided. Those are some basic human
assumptions.
I guess assumptions that
right,
even you, if another religionist were to make a claim like that, you would say, wait a minute, those things don't happen normally.
Yeah, well.
Normally they don't.
Normally, yeah.
When exactly.
You say it's normative. I'm privy to certain experiences in my youth where I've seen some incredibly unusual things that I know for a fact cannot be explained in naturalistic ways. I wanted to be a marine biologist, and in high school I took all the high, tough classes, and I wanted to go into science. And so I'm very familiar with the scientific method and with logic and stuff. I know that there are some things that cannot be explained. The evidence, well, actually I got a listing here. I'll go down in the order. So there's the absence of evidence. Well, how do you know? I mean, you could say, from what I understand with atheists, what they can say is, I've actually tried to help atheists with this. You can't say there is no evidence for God, because that would mean you have to know all evidences. It's not logically coherent for you to hold that position. I could say, or an atheist could say, I've seen no convincing evidence. Now, that's not a problem, intellectually. So your position would logically have to be that you've not seen any convincing evidences that God exists.
Well, it's just like the picture on the box of Lucky Charms. You could say that's evidence for leprechauns, right?
Yeah.
But is it convincing evidence? Would you consider that picture on Lucky Charms to be evidence for leprechauns? I guess you would, mm-hmm. because it's evidence that there are people who believe in leprechauns, right? So mm-hmm. in that sense, I'll agree with you. I mean, but...
Is it sufficient evidence? That deals with the presuppositions. Because if I were to present an evidence to you, you're going to interpret it in an atheistic manner. I'm going to interpret it possibly in a theistic manner.
You're right. Right. Is it sufficient is a very important point, but it's even more than that. It's the fact that this proffered evidence that we do have actually does have pretty good naturalistic explanations for it. We do know how leprechaun myths are created. Mm-hmm. We understand that. So it's not just that it's insufficient evidence, it looks like it's evidence not for leprechauns, it's evidence for belief in leprechauns. It's evidence right. for a cultural phenomenon.
Right.
So it's evidence for something, but is it actually evidence for real leprechauns? And so in the same way, I guess you're right, there's evidence for a God, but is it evidence that points to a God, or is it evidence that points to the cultural attempt to create
right.
understandable myths to explain our existence. So, it's
right.
you know, a God can be evidence of culture or religion or whatever.
Yeah, like leprechauns on a box.
Yeah.
There's evidence that people believe in that, whether or not
yeah.
they exist is another topic. Well, if God is transcendental, now I can only argue for the Christian God. You know, I'll agree with you. All the rest of them just don't exist or false. Whatever you want to say, not a problem. I'll stand in your corner and refute them.
So you're atheistic in that negative sense about those gods.
Oh, no. I'm not just atheistic. I'm antagonistic.
Toward those gods. Okay.
Oh, yes.
So you don't have a belief. In one sense, we agree with each other.
I not only don't have a belief, I believe they don't exist.
Right.
I believe they're false. They're fabrications.
Well, because you've picked one, so obviously it makes sense.
He picked me, but that's another story. Maybe I'll tell you on the way back to the hotel. If God is transcendent, I'm going to assume the Christian perspective here just for a bit. In Christian theology, God has something called aseity, and that is that he is independent of all things, and he created the universe. And so if he created the universe, I'm skipping some steps, but just to keep it kind of concise here. If he created the universe, then he is other than it, and he would be transcendent in relationship to it. And he would not be dependent upon it in any way for his existence or his decisions or whatever. This is the Christian concept of God, the immutability, the independence, he's the creator. Therefore, evidence would, if we were to look at evidence within the Christian, within the materialistic worldview, or just within this realm, say this physical realm, then evidence would be that which would be materialistically oriented. But we have what's called a category mistake. If God is transcendent and outside of the universe, and we're looking for evidence inside the universe, then intellectually we could come at an impasse, because how do you find evidence for the transcendent being in a materialistic realm? And I find this logistically a problem for atheists, that I brought this up before. It's like saying, how much does how valuable is the Mona Lisa painting? Well, I'll tell you, let me get my bathroom scale. Well, we don't judge value by how much it weighs. It's a category mistake. God's transcendence is not discernible through mere evidential means. If God were to be transcendental and he was existing, then we would have to look for evidence that would be consistent with a transcendental being. Not just, to be overly simplified, hey, look, I found him underneath our microscope or behind that rock, that kind of a thing.
Well, then you're agreeing with me.
What?
As far as the basic definition of evidence is, there's no evidence for a God. If you want to redefine evidence to include a transcendent component, fine, that'll get you where you want to go. But you're agreeing with me basically that there is no what we would call basic evidence for a God.
But I would agree that there is evidence for God. Because if we were to, this is what I mean, if God existed, hypothetically, we can do a thought exercise. I know you can certainly do this.
If leprechauns existed too. Right?
Well, let's just do God. And he's transcendent.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. Well, transcendence means he is independent of the created order, and he is not limited to the time and space of that created order.
But whatever that means. I mean, you can say those words, but whatever that means is a different question. But go ahead.
Okay. And so if you were to communicate to us, then any communication to us would have to be self-motivated. It couldn't be that we would drag him down out of the heavens and say, here, show me you, or show you to myself. It would have to be, and it would also by nature be authoritative. And we could expect certain miraculous
Where did you things. Get authoritative?
Well, because if he's God, and whatever he says is true and good.
By
and
definition.
Right. Yeah, by definition.
I mean, there could be a God who's not authoritative. There could be a God who's not
Mormon.
Loving. There could be a God who's not loving. There could be a God. I mean, there's all you're basically boxing your definition of God by a certain definition that Christians have. Oh. But we can go with that. I'm just saying.
Let's do that. I could.
There are hundreds of other ways to define this being, mm-hmm. and you're defining it a particular way.
The Christian way. The Christian way. But I could deal with the issue of, and believe me, I've had lots of discussions about this with atheists, and the issue of one could be unjust. Well, then that would be an internal contradiction, which is violate the laws of logic, and how do you justify the laws of logic, the necessary transcendentals, which are conceptual entities. We can get into all kinds of stuff. It gets way too complicated for this
Talk
right
about
now.
Talk about category errors. You just committed a bunch of them, but go ahead.
I wouldn't think so, but to continue, if this transcendent being were to communicate to us, then by nature, at least in the Christian perspective, what he would say would be authoritative. And I think it would be fair to assume that any communication with us would be by definition miraculous. And if he were to become, as Christ says, and I'm skipping a lot of steps, he was God in flesh, according to what the scripture says, then we would expect the miraculous with him. If we were to presuppose, as we can presuppose God doesn't exist, we can presuppose God does exist and work from different presuppositions.
Or presuppose nothing and just go with what the evidence is.
Well, I would say that the evidence then would demonstrate God exists. And there's reasons for that. Now, I'm kind of shifting gears right now, but the evidence is if we have any moral absolutes, if we have any rational absolutes, which are conceptual entities which cannot be justified in a transcendental way from an atheistic perspective, we have various issues that just don't make sense, in my opinion, from an atheist perspective. In fact, that's what I was going to present to you tonight if I was going to debate you. An argument based on the idea of the impossibility of the contrary. You only have two worldviews, God, no God. And there's no it's an antinomic pair. There's no third option. God exists or God does not exist.
Okay, but hold on a second. That's a kind of a binary fallacy because
yes,
on
is.
The God
it's
side,
binary.
There could be 1,000 different definitions of a God. But you're right. Either there is some kind of a God by whatever definition or there isn't. I mean, that's just Boolean, basically.
Yeah, but we could get into the issues of the let's just say the particulars of that Christian God, because I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I may put this in this book. Maybe we could do dialogues. I could put some of the dialogues in the book. We could discuss some of these things. People might like that chapter if you're interested.
Have you read George Smith's book on atheism?
No.
So put that down. That's a must read.
George Smith. Is he an atheist?
Yes. It's a classic. If you're going to write a book about atheism, you should at least read the classic authors. George Smith's Atheism, The Case Against God. That's back in the 70s.
Yeah. I've seen that.
And his definition of atheism clears up a lot of confusion because there's a lot of believers who think they know what atheism is without having actually read the atheist authors. So in your book. And then next, after George Smith, then Michael Martin.
Martin.
Have you read his book?
I don't know. I've read so much.
Well, those are classic. You got to start with those if you're going to write a book about atheism. Michael Martin, the philosopher in Massachusetts, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification,
okay.
in which he does tackle, although I think too briefly, he does tackle the transcendental argument
really?
To some degree. And in later writings, Michael Martin has some really good essays on the presuppositionalist transcendental arguments.
Oh, that would be really good.
So you need to at least look at those.
Absolutely. Two. I will absolutely do that. And the issue of definition of God actually kind of came up recently. And, man, there's so many things I want to talk about. Let me just get back to that in a sec. And so if this transcendental being did exist and wanted to communicate to us, then we would expect certain things. They're certainly just logical.
Why would we expect it?
Well, if he's going to reveal himself to us, then it would be by definition self-imposed. It couldn't be that we go out to the God of the universe and say, here, show me yourself.
Maybe not. I mean, it's possible. I mean, there might be an ant colony somewhere that you prod and get a reaction out of it. There could be a God that we prod to get a reaction from. It wouldn't be necessarily self-imposed.
Then he wouldn't be transcendental.
Why not? If he created us and we're part of his total whatever sphere he lives in, mm-hmm. and if there's possibility of one-way communication, then there's a possibility of two ways. So it wouldn't necessarily yeah. have to be self-prompted. It could be like us tugging on his garment saying, hey, I need your attention. So it's possible, I mean, logically, that it could be two-way.
Oh, man. Not enough time. I wish we could be here like 2 weeks in a row. I mean, every day, and I would just go through stuff. The nature of God's existence would require certain logical steps and internal consistencies within his nature and his essence in order for him to even have the ability of existence. We could not have a self-refuting God because we would know that that which is self-refuting cannot be true.
Well, that's a good hypothesis.
Yes, it is. And it,
but
it,
I mean, it doesn't necessarily, I mean, there are other definitions and other hypotheses for other types of God, but the Christian God has a certain, I understand, I used to preach this, so I understand this, and I wasn't necessarily the exact theology that you are, which two Christians are the same exact theology, I mean, really, but I do understand where you're coming from, and I used to preach sermons similar to that, especially regarding free will and...
That's a whole other topic. You yeah. can't have free will in an atheistic worldview. Let's see. So, definition of God. Let me just kind of jump aside here a little bit and get to that. I've had atheists ask me this lately. You can't even define who God really is, Matt. And I'll say, well, yes, I can, but I have to use attributes. And they'll say it's not good enough to do that. And so you'll be the first one I'm going to ask this. I'll say, well, I will define God's nature and essence if you can also define, if you will, define human nature and essence. What I find is that atheists very often want to do what they will not be willing to do themselves. They'll require of Christians, excuse me, to do what they are not able to do. If we're to take a man and cut his arms and legs off, he's still by nature human. If we take his eyes out, he's still human. If he's unconscious, he's still human. If he's on a heart machine, he's still human. The essence of something can only be discerned by its properties, it would seem, that we can define something, but we can only do it by attributes. The same thing applies with God. It's fair to say, well, his attributes are, and then we describe him by his attributes. But I've seen a lot of atheists say, no, I don't even want you to describe his attributes, describe his essence. And yet, the very nature describing him is by his attributes, the same if I were to ask an atheist now, I'll apply that to you in the nature of humanity. Do you see the point?
Yeah, I do, and I think I see what's wrong with it.
Okay,
I would define, if the word essence means anything at all, if it means, let's assume that it does, and that you could apply it to biological organisms such as us or a horse or a sea slug or whatever, it has an essence, then I would say that we could, no matter what you do, no matter how many arms or fingers or noses you cut off, you could still look at the DNA of the biological organism called a human mm-hmm. being, and you could say, yes, that is human DNA. It's physical. It's acid. It's a structure with the you right. know those
nucleotides.
And right. you could look at it, and you could say that's not an essence. That's a definition of what it means to be human. If you looked at it and said, oh, there's 2% different here, and you notice, oh, that's not a human. That's a chimpanzee because we're very close to chimpanzee. And you could tell. We can define what you might say is the essence of humanity by our biological properties. We are biological organs within a natural environment. So the question that I think those atheists are asking you and that I would ask you as well is, the Bible defines God as a spirit. Mm-hmm. God is a spirit, and mm-hmm. those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth, right? Mm-hmm. What is spirit? And if God is spirit something that God is made of? Are there spiritual atoms? What is a spirit? Whenever believers, and I'm going to ask you this, whenever believers attempt to define what spirit is, they define what it's not: intangible, non-corporeal, ineffable,
yep.
you know, and so, but never define what it actually is. And if you don't have a definition for what it actually is, then how can you even define what this God is who's made out of this thing? You may as well say God is a blah or a pluff. You may as well say that. If you don't have a definition for what you are describing this being as, then how does it differ from nothing at all, basically? And the question's open. I'm not saying that this disproves God. I'm asking you to give me a coherent, it doesn't have to be DNA. It doesn't have to be even, whatever it is, though, in order to be identifiable, it'd have to be measurable in some way. It would have to be different from what it's not in some way. A spirit right. would have to be different from nothingness in some way to be the essence of what a spiritual being is. So what is spirit?
Don't know. I've had atheists ask me this 100 times, and I tell them, we don't know because the Bible says God is spirit, but doesn't define what it is. It only does it in the negative. This is what it's not, which would be consistent if God were, we have a saying in theology, holy other, W-H-O-L-L-Y, wholly, completely different than what we are. But, and because our senses don't extend into that realm, we can't relate to what it is. We can only talk about the things that he is not in our perspective.
But our senses don't extend into the infrared radio nope. frequency, right? But we can still define it, even though it's...
Because
it's
we have tools,
it's
and we
invisible.
Can use our senses, right?
So how do you know that the word spirit is referring to anything at all?
Well, I do, because John 4:24, Jesus says God is spirit, so it's referring to the nature of
but
God.
But how do you
spirit.
Know John is telling the truth? How do you know that he even knows what that word means?
Well, that's in the subjectivity now.
Well, how do you know that that author meant something by that word, if you don't even know what that word means? What did John mean when he wrote that word?
Well, it's an epistemological issue at this point. And when you ask me that, I have to jump, not just from the issue of the logic of what he actually meant, because it's not a fair question for someone to say, I want you to go back 2,000 years and understand what John's mind meant about something. That's just not a realistic
thing.
But
he used the word pneuma or pneuma, however right. you say
pneuma.
It.
Just pneuma.
Modern
right.
Greeks would say pneuma, but the ancient the scholars would say
right.
pneuma.
Right.
So it means wind or breath in
wind
the Greek,
or breath
which
or, yeah.
probably is a metaphor for what spirit actually really...
Well, it might be, but...
Because it's not air molecules moving. Spirit is not
no.
actual molecules.
No.
It's and you think they would have chosen that word because air, although air is a thing, it's a gas, it's not visible, so it seems like it's an invisible thing that moves, although we can
right.
define... You can weigh air. You can measure air. You can measure air pressure. So air is something that you can actually define and measure. But
right.
obviously, that word
that's physical.
Air must that word air must be a synonym or a metaphor for something else, right?
But these are physical things. We as human beings, we have senses, and we are able to detect our environment through our senses.
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and infrared, we alter the information or the phenomena with instruments so that we can see it according to the senses.
Well, we don't see it.
We
don't detect it. We know that it is there, but we don't see it.
Right. We have machines that tell us it's there, and we're able to sense it in the sense of, I guess you could say, is a analogy through the machines that say, hey, look at this, look at that.
And we can mathematically define it, and it's logically one of the frequencies of you know,
right.
radiation. We know that infrared and ultraviolet and radio and microwave, we know all these frequencies and x-rays are coming from the sun and other parts of the universe.
We can detect them.
Yeah.
And so this is the property of materialism, where the spirit aspect is not. So we could say that it's probably close to a category mistake to say, define what spirit is, even though it's outside of our domain of material existence.
Well, on the day of Pentecost, they were speaking in other tongues, and then mm-hmm. suddenly
the Holy
these
Spirit.
Spirits came into them like tongues of flame,
right.
flames of fire, and came into each of these human beings. So whatever they were, they came and inhabited particular individuals
right.
within a particular space-time coordinate, which somehow stuck with their brains as they walked around and did not, there was no collateral damage. There were not other people getting hit by those same spirits.
Right.
So according to the Bible, spirit does seem to occupy space.
Not necessarily.
Doesn't it go along with your, it's in your brain but not mine, right? And as you move across the room, somehow it's tethered to your body in some way, right? I mean, it's not just everywhere. A spirit, according to the Bible, is a localized thing, and it was even described as tongues of fire. So there was at least some attempt to give a definition of what spirit is in the Bible, but what does that mean?
Don't know what it exactly means.
It looked hot and fire-like.
Hot and fire-like. Hence the issue of describing it by its attributes.
Well, they saw something.
They saw something.
Yeah, so yeah. Something visible.
I'm glad you admit that.
Something visible then, mm-hmm. So it has physical properties.
Yeah, it has properties that we can detect.
Which would be then measurable in some way.
Well, properties are measurable. If they had some cameras back there, maybe they could have measured its intensity of the light. I mean, who knows? But I would think that anything that has a physical manifestation in our realm would be detectable and measurable to some degree. So no problem with that. I'm agreeing with it.
So you're admitting you don't really know what it is. Nobody
exactly.
knows what it is. Nobody can define it. So
God does.
It's just a word.
No, it's not just a word.
See, you're saying the word God, but God by definition is spirit. And if you say we don't know what spirit is, but you say God, you may as well be consistent and say with the word God, who is made of spirit or is spirit, God, you don't even know what that is either, because it's God is a spirit.
Well, we don't know what God is by nature and essence because he is transcendent and wholly other. Therefore, we can only detect him by his self-revelation and by the attributes or the properties that he exhibits in our world, which is perfectly fair, perfectly logical, because just as things in the universe exist and we detect their existence by the properties that they represent, so too with God.
So you are detecting spirit yourself?
Yeah.
You are?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you and I'm not?
Because I'm saved, you're not.
Why?
Because God has not granted you that repentance.
So you're somehow better. You somehow have something that I don't.
Yes, I have something you don't.
Right. So you're chosen and special. And what? Am I blind? Am I blind? Am I lacking something? Am I?
Yes, you're lacking the Spirit of God.
What is that? What is it that I'm lacking?
The presence of God in your heart.
A word that means nothing, that you can't define, that you admit that you can't even tell us what it is. You have it, and I don't.
But not knowing or not being able to define what it is doesn't mean that the attributes aren't there to help us determine that it does exist.
Is it a feeling in your brain?
There's some of that, yeah.
A feeling. So feelings are neuronal, and so those are physical. So you're like a radio receiver that's getting a transmission from...
This is getting fun.
Well, these are good questions.
Now what you're doing is using the same analogous system that I am. You're talking about relationships to properties, relationships to attributes.
So I'm flawed, basically. I don't have the receivers.
We're all flawed.
I don't have the receptors within me to be able to perceive
receptors?
What you can, whatever it is. You're perceiving it and I'm not.
Why would I just say that God has chosen to reveal himself to me and not you?
But you are a biological organ.
Yes, I am.
And you are perceiving something from mm-hmm. a transcendent realm, right?
Yes, I would think so.
The biological organ is somehow receiving it in some way.
Yeah, because the Spirit of God lives in me, yes.
And it's physical because your brain is now registering it, right? So there's a physical side
or
to
my
it.
Spirit.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And you somehow have this, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it, receptor or ability or specialness right. that I don't. We atheists yeah. don't have.
Right.
Well, then how can you fault us? If we don't have it, how can you fault us?
Well, because everybody's obligated to believe in God by the nature and the essence of his righteousness. He says, be holy for I'm holy, 1 Peter 1:16.
Those are just words.
They're not just words.
Those are words on a book written by ancient people.
Yes.
Why do you trust them?
Because, oh boy.
They made mistakes.
They made mistakes. There's two answers I could give you. One is I have done the history and the looking into the documents.
So a lot of people. A lot of people have.
Yeah, I'm convinced it's
like
fine.
Bart Ehrman and people who are convinced that it is contradictory.
I'm convinced it's not.
Okay,
I know what a contradiction
fine.
Is.
So we disagree on that.
But I've also, and this is, I don't like often bringing this up to the atheists because it's nearly not fair, but I've had an experience of God's presence. And let me tell you, I don't use this as a proof. I don't use this as anything other than, I have.
Well, it's a proof of something.
It's a proof of something. And, you know, the way I bring this up is I say, and I mean this never happened to you or any atheist or anybody, but I've had to bury my child. My wife and I buried a son about 20 years ago. And it was one of the worst experiences of our lives.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be overly emotional, but I only bring that up to say the level of intensity of emotional awareness and trauma could be imagined.
You can't be over emotional about something like that. Yeah, I mean, that's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah.
And so I'm always careful when I bring this up because atheists can't deal with this. Not that they're insufficient. It's just almost not fair. But the thing is, the level of intensity of that, you can imagine. Well, I had an experience of the Lord Jesus Christ. I'm an intelligent guy. I've never done drugs. I don't get drunk. I don't do that stuff. I've never, no, he came. He was there. And his presence brought to me an expression of emotional fervor that was so great that it made the worst day of my life burying my son pale in comparison. I was aware of his presence. I was aware. Nobody could convince me otherwise, because I was an agnostic 1 minute and 2-3 minutes later, absolutely convinced. That happened 40 years ago. Now, I can't present that to you as a proof, and I don't.
Because you know it's not.
Because not a proof, absolutely not. But I know the experience I've had. I know the reality. I remember it. I remember the sensation of otherness, of holiness. I remember it. And trust me, if it happened to you...
Oh. It did happen to me.
No, not like that.
Yes, it did. I had those experiences.
It can't.
What do you mean? How do you know that?
Because...
How do you know? Am I a liar? I had those experiences, Matt.
I'm not calling you a liar at all.
I felt those experiences. I felt the presence of God in my life. I felt the reality of Jesus. I felt... Mm-hmm. I got the goosebumps. I got all of that. It was very real, and I'm not discounting your experience. I think what happened to you is a very powerful, very real experience, and it happens in all religions. I was debating a Hindu the other day who told me the same thing. Shiva appeared to this Hindu Vedic astrologer.
Mm-hmm. A demon, yeah.
In very real terms. Happened to him in extremely... Mm-hmm. Catholics with the Virgin Mary. I mean,
a demon, yep.
These things happen. Mm-hmm. And some of them would say that your experience was with a demon as well.
They could say it. We could have a discussion.
Exactly. So it's a subjective thing, and you're admitting
it's
that it's not proof.
Subjective. I will admit
exactly.
It's not proof.
And many
atheists... is why I know John was telling the truth, because I know who he was following. Jesus.
Many atheists have these horrible life experiences as well and get through them just fine without some transcendent.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, Charles Bradlaugh, who stood by the grave of his own son, the atheist in England, he stood there saying, I understand the temptation to want there to be a life after death, but I'm not going to sacrifice my reason at the altar of wishful thinking and good feelings. Good feelings are amazing, they're powerful, but they're not proof of anything.
A lot of people do sacrifice their reason just for the sake of feelings, and sometimes that's appropriate and sometimes it's not. But I'm a very reasonable man who looks at the evidence with as much objectivity as I can. And this is why I believe that atheism and the presuppositions that the atheists hold are inconsistent with actuality, cannot be defended from an atheistic perspective, and demonstrate that atheism as a worldview, as a position, cannot be tenable. And we haven't the time to go into that, which I wish we did, which is why I wanted you here yesterday, because it didn't work out. And then we could really kind of clean up the mess created yesterday by today. We're making a mess now. But you see, when atheists, I'm glad you're doing this because it's helping me. When atheists ask me to define what God is, I can only do it by the attributes. And atheists don't want that. What they want to do is try and, I'm not trying to be, you know, mind reader here, but get to the place of having an excuse not to believe in God because they don't want him definable. If you can't define him, you can't know him.
No atheist would say they don't want God to be definable. No atheist would say
that's
that.
The impression
I don't know
I
who
get.
You've talked to about that.
That's just the impression I get from them.
Well, because...
I think you're a little bit different, though.
In order for me to wrap my head around anybody's definition of a god, whatever it is, let's say it's Shiva in the Indian subcontinent, right? Well, one of my American Indian ancestors, I belong to a Native American tribe, you know, Sukalan Ajos. In order to wrap my mind around what that is, I have to have some kind of cogent definitional... You know what I mean? I have to have something. If you're defining God by his attributes, well, attributes are attributes of something.
Right.
They're human attributes, you know, skill at playing chess or playing basketball or whatever are attributes of a biological organism that can be measured. So it's not illogical to ask, well, if you're defining these attributes, what are they attributes of? We want to know that. Is that a bad question?
No, that's not a bad question at all.
But the word God, as you admit, is defined by something that can't even be defined that you don't even understand.
Oh, no, so I would say we can define him.
But you said spirit is something you don't understand and can't define, and God is
spirit. Spirit is a quality of the being. It is not that he is that. It's anymore.
The Bible says God is. That's what he is. It doesn't say that's his attribute or quality.
Right. It's talking about the incorporeal aspect of God's essence. And that's what is going on, because in Luke 24:39, Jesus says, spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have. So spirit is something other than the mere physical aspect. God, he says God is spirit, but he doesn't define what that is. We don't know.
Okay, but that's
God
fine.
Other.
You can define any way you like. I mean, I'm not telling you what God to define or how you want to define it. I'm just saying that don't fault us skeptics. Or some of us skeptics would like to believe. There are some atheists who say, I'm going to be right there with you, Matt, as long as it's going to make some sense to me.
But isn't that
so
kind
it's
of
not
dangerous?
That they have some worldview that is anti-God. It's not that we we don't want there to be a God because we don't want any moral restraints, or we don't, you know what I mean? It's not that. It's just that we want to know what's true. And the basic question that should be asked is it true? And if I'm going to decide if it's true, I have to have some criteria. I have to have something that I wrap my mind around. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to take it by faith. I might take it by probability. I might say, you know what, Matt, you got it up to 55%. All right, let's go with it. You know, I might do that. I might, let's round it off. Like with leprechauns, leprechauns are probably what, 2%, 1% probable? Let's round it down to zero. And you and I would both say, all right, there's no leprechauns, mm-hmm. right? We would say that informally. Right. And most atheists are like that. You know, they're thinking in probabilistic terms, but when on the street, they're going to say, all right, there's no God. Let's round this off, right? Or unless you can come up with something that convinces me. I'm the one being asked to make a decision. Not by your criteria, not by your definitions. I'm the one being asked to decide, and here are my criteria for deciding.
Well, that's just it. As an atheist, you would have certain criteria that are subjective. They're not objective standards, but subjective standards based upon your presuppositions and your assumptions.
And well, what else are we? You're doing the same thing.
Yeah, but are our assumptions internally consistent, and do they comport with actuality? That's the question.
Well, if they don't, then explain how they don't, right?
Well, for example, atheism cannot account for the laws of logic, which are themselves transcendental.
Who said that? Who made that rule? The laws of logic are transcendental.
The laws of logic do not depend upon space and time for their validity.
Well, that's a different use of the word transcendental.
Transcendental means that it's not dependent on space and time. As I said earlier, that's what it meant. The laws of logic are not dependent upon human minds. They're not dependent upon conventions or voting and things like that. Chemical processes don't produce logical absolutes, which atheists discover are true.
You're treating logical absolutes as if they were things.
They are. They're abstractions.
How do you know that?
Because they're of the mind.
But they're not things. Yeah. Just like... For example, here's a bad analogy, but at least it's useful, okay? The mind is a biological organ. So is the stomach.
The brain is a biological organ. The mind is a function of the brain.
Yeah, exactly. The mind is a function of a function, is what I would say. The brain. So the stomach is also a biological organism that functions in a certain way. And what it does, we call digestion. Digestion is not really a thing. It doesn't exist. There's no capital D digestion out in the universe, right? It's just a word that we use for how the organ is functioning. So as a functionalist, the human brain is functioning in such a way that it produces... Oh. Are we out of time?
We are out of time. Man, it was getting good because we want to jump into that. Hey, Dan, I want to thank you for coming in. This is Dan Barker. Thanks for coming in.
You're very articulate. Thank you. I like you. You're a good guy. You're a friend. So
we made
some progress here.
We did. I think we were getting down. Oh, I wish we had another hour. It'd be awesome. Hey, folks, God bless. I hope you enjoyed the show. And I'll be back in the studio on Monday. Have a great day. Talk to you later. Bye.
Want more? Go online now to CARM.org. CARM, the Christian Apologetics Research Ministry. Read Matt's articles on hundreds of topics. Enroll in up to 3 online schools, which will take you to the next level and beyond in your knowledge of the Christian faith, theology, apologetics, and critical thinking. Interact on the forums. Download past radio shows, interviews, and debates. And for a limited time, request a free book specially chosen by Matt Slick. That's CARM.org. We'll see you next time on Matt Slick Live.